Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the TF Podcast, where we discuss technology, finance, and business. We have guests from all over the world, usually around investors and founders. I'm really excited for my next guest. Her name is Minda Bruce, and she is the co-founder of First Row Partners, as well as the 1K Project. I've known Minda for quite a few years now, so it's great to have her on the show and just catch up this way. So with that, Minda, if you could go ahead and introduce yourself to everybody, that'd be great.
Absolutely. So as Jonathan said, I am co-founder of First Row Partners, which is a venture firm I co-founded with Yoko Okano. It's a micro VC firm anchored here in the Pacific Northwest. And I'm also co-founder of the 1K Project, which is sort of a exciting side project that I started with Alex Iskold out of New York to address the global pandemic and the economic crisis that's been the fallout of that. So, that's what I'm doing right now.
Cool. I'm excited to dig deep into both of those. It's been great actually seeing the 1K project as you started just a few months ago and just the success you've had there. So I'm excited to talk about that. But, before we even get to that point is, give us a little bit of your background. And, I know you you've been in tech for quite a while and, so you've been on the founder side and now you're on the VC side. So I'd love you to kind of walk us through that a bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Being a micro VC means managing a fund that is, less than 50 million. And Yoko and I are just getting started. So we don't have a large set of investors yet, but we're building an investing firm and we're already making investments with our own funds. But that's been a journey to get there. And it really builds on all the experience I had prior. And so just to kind of step back, where I started was in Silicon Valley in 95, which was awesome timing, and just lots of really interesting things going on. So I got to be part of what is now called SaaS, but back then we weren't calling it that, and got to be a part of some really interesting startups, as well as work for as a consultant for some really interesting iconic tech companies like Motorola and Siemens and HP and LSI Logic and places like that. And so that was a really exciting and formative experience as a just be in touch with the entrepreneurial ecosystem and the opportunities that were there. And then as I moved up to Seattle, I continued to sort of do both. I would say I divided my life into three parts. Parenting my young children, leadership, community volunteering, and working on startups. And so those sort of were the three things. And then those three things have really been at play in my life and career ever since I moved back to Seattle about 15 years ago. And as a startup founder here in the Northwest, I had the opportunity to get really involved with the startup ecosystem and have really enjoyed participating in that. And through my enthusiastic participation, built a really wide network and got to know a lot of different founders. And that led to being able to explore angel investing and learn the investing landscape, do some advising, and then ultimately really finding a partner like Yoko where, we could launch a micro VC firm and play a different role in the ecosystem on the other side of the table. That's how I sort of transitioned from being on the founder,
sure,
operator side through sort of understanding what angels and investing and that space were, and then founding the firm earlier this year.
I find that super interesting too, because, as a founder, it's always nice to speak with VCs that have also been founders, have been, in startups, and, mm-hmm. you know that when they're telling you how to operate a early stage company, they've also operated early stage. I think that's refreshing. Obviously there's character traits or traits that those that haven't also offer at different stages, but no, I think that's a really good, point of view. And when I want to touch on this micro VC aspect, right? Because some might not be familiar, and you touched on this a little bit, right? Like, hey, a VC that manages under 50 mil, what are some other aspects of a micro VC, or how might you describe that or explain that to someone that might not be aware of how that works?
Yeah, I think we were the first early institutional money into these, into startups. And so a lot of times we're right alongside angels and angel groups in terms of the stage of investment, sometimes even earlier than some angels. And so You know, we have outside investors, we have a portfolio strategy and investing thesis. Our check size is usually, as micro VCs, are anywhere, you know, under 500K, but usually in the 2 to 500K range is pretty typical for a micro VC. But the space really sort of opened up as a result of the, sort of the stretching out of funding between starting a company and doing a Series A. And as that time frame expanded, it got beyond what just individual angel investors could do and what larger VCs were able to do to reach down into that space. And so it sort of created this market gap that micro VCs are filling, where we can be catalysts for these early first rounds and with, you know, substantial checks, quick professional decision-making, and you know, then galvanizing other investment to come along with it. And then having the professional relationships with people at the next stage to really help our companies make it through to that Series A place. So I think that that's the role that micro VCs are playing. And a lot of us are former operators and angels. Others are coming out of venture firms. There are a lot of different ways that people kind of come into this space. But for Yoko and I, it was just a match with our operator background and the space that we occupy with our network.
And I agree, like, that it's definitely, there's definitely a gap there without the micro VC, just like you're saying, because, you know, maybe you're a more experienced founder, or, you might not want to, you know, operate on the angel side and you want to go for VC, but maybe you're too small for VC, or, you know, and then there's also a lot of VCs that might say that they're pre-seed when in fact they're not actually pre-seed. You know, they might be, if the right perfect deal happens, but not
exactly. You know, for it's like they do sometimes write those checks at that stage, but not always. And so I hope that what we can be is a really productive use of founders' time, and that we can also band together to support each other's rounds and, you know, share deals as much as possible. So, you know, Kirby from Ascend VC and, you know, Tim Chen, other folks in the ecosystem around here in Seattle and then nationally, you know, it's really sort of arising as something that I think is really exciting. And it's really been, you know, I think that if you look at some of the stats that Silicon Valley and the National Venture Capital Association sort of come out about this, there's really been an explosion of micro VC firms. And so there's a lot of reasons why, market dynamics, but I'm really excited to be part of it. It just really suits the kind of investing that Yoko and I want to do and what we're best at.
Totally. Yeah, it seems like there's a good opportunity to be a little bit more hands-on too, and supportive and so forth.
Yeah. I mean, that's just our nature in general, I think, is to want to be sort of what I call noses in, fingers out. Because, you know, as former operators, we're not there to like direct what a founder does. If we feel we need to do that, maybe we picked the wrong team, right? They should really be the ones that we look to for you know, navigating this, but we always want to be able to be a resource, whether that is in helping in recruiting, helping, you know, with being a sounding board, helping resolve any issues that arise in the team, just, you know, whatever it is that's not going right. We always just want to be the people that you call.
Most definitely. That's excellent. And so, so you're fundraising for that right now. And, you know, like you said, you're writing your own checks, and then, COVID-19 happens and you think, hey, like, we should help out some folks, because there's a lot of people hurting right now, and you start the 1K project. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, it's a really interesting origin story. It's a kind of a Twitter success story, so to speak, too, which is really interesting to me, because people are always saying like, oh, you know, Twitter, like, you know, it's not worth anything. You're just, you know, making a bunch of noise out there. But I think I've got a good Twitter success for you here.
I make better engagements and relationships over Twitter than I do over any other network.
Yeah.
So I agree.
Exactly. Absolutely. So what it was is that Yoko and I were really geared up to build a whole bunch of relationships with founders and investors. And with the inability to travel and then obvious need for you know, different kinds of support, we realized like we were not able to assist in any sort of medical capacity. We couldn't sew masks, we're not that crafty, but we did know how to connect people and money. And so we figured that maybe that was something we ought to be focused on. And we were really interested, and we talked with another friend of ours here locally, and really sort of looked at like who needs help and what's the fastest way to get to them. And the people that we really felt were not getting help fast enough were the folks that were not part of the social safety net prior to COVID, but who lost employment and any economic income opportunities in this crisis. So that's service workers, you know, freelancers, anyone who's sort of self-employed or a gig economy worker was immediately displaced from any income. And those folks also didn't have the opportunity to build up a savings buffer. And so they were immediately in a financial crisis and they didn't expect to be there. And that we really wanted to keep them in their existing life and not have them slide into needing the social safety net. So we wanted to see, could we build a bridge for them to be able to get to more, you know, institutional kinds of support structures or somehow sort of catch up with their lives or get new employment. But we really felt like that was an interesting population that was being, you know, whose needs were not being met and who needed help really quickly. So as we were having these conversations and thoughts like about what we could do to connect people and money, Alex Iskold published a poll on Twitter saying, what do you think about, you know, individuals giving other individuals $1,000 a month for 3 months as a way to, you know, help them through the economic crisis. And so I was one of many people who sort of said, like, that's really interesting. Let's talk more. And so Alex and I got on the phone the next day, and we'd met really briefly once in Seattle when he was here. But, you know, he's the co-founder and a general partner at 2048 VC in New York City. So we had sort of some of that in common, but when we started talking, we weren't talking about venture capital and startups. We were talking about the fact that there were families hurting out there and they needed help right away.
Yeah.
And we were both really interested in the direct giving model where I, you know, connect individuals with other individuals and have there be sort of some sort of way and mechanism for them to, you know, have those funds go just between the two of them. And so as we started talking about it, we really just had a lot of common shared viewpoints about how this might go. And so we got a group of about 20 people together and really quickly started applying all of our entrepreneurial skills and tech knowledge and bringing a team together to create this sort of organized chaos that was enabling us to move really, really fast and fund families as we built processes and systems that would scale. So we really sort of did that crawl, walk, run. But we were funding families the entire time. So we didn't sort of take a couple weeks to build something. We just started going. And I think that that tone and that pace has been really good. We've also you know, just been really intentionally in the first part of it, focused, narrow, and sort of intentionally short-sighted. And so it was a really interesting sort of application of all of my, and Alex too, of our sort of founder and tech entrepreneur skills, but applied to this particular problem.
Yeah.
So within 10 weeks, we had raised and helped, you know, channel $1 million to over 350 families. So we moved really fast and I'm really proud of what we did because that wasn't just one big donor. That was, you know, many, many, many donors coming in, you know, over, I think 200 some donors supporting 350 families.
So. Yeah, that's fantastic. Because if I remember right, if you're donating, you're supporting or you're committing to supporting a family for a couple months. Is that right?
So initially we rolled out with a really simple message, which is, you know, sign up to sponsor one family with $1,000 a month for 3 months. So you're making a, you know, $3,000 commitment, or if you're going to do five families, you know, multiply that by 5, 15. And so, you know, we galvanized a lot of people to do that. And then we realized that also people wanted to collectively help families. And so what really sort of enabled us to roll forward on that is that we had a sponsor sort of come in and say, I'd like to give you guys $20,000 and see what you can really leverage it to do. And so we were like, okay, let's see what we can do with this. And maybe we can enable something different. So we did this sort of what I think of as reverse match opportunity. So what we do is we take a family that we've approved and we create the GoFundMe page for them, which is our mechanism for sort of the peer-to-peer you know, money transfer to happen. Sure. And we put $1,000 in there from the donor's money. And then that family then gets that initial first month's funding right away. while we then crowdfund the rest. And so then what we do is we say, text us at this number with, you know, $100 or more, what you want to give, and then we'll send you the link for the family we're currently funding, and then you can donate directly to that. So people are still getting a direct giving experience, but they're able to do it at a smaller increment, and we're still able to fund the family that first $1,000 for their first month really quickly when we fund them. So, you know, we've been working and problem solving all these kinds of things as we go, but, you know, the fundamentals of the program are really direct giving, and that we are peer-to-peer. We don't hold any cash, and we're not in the middle of the transaction at all. We simply set up a GoFundMe page, and it's the sponsor that ultimately decides to sponsor a family whose story we present to them. But then there's sort of this third aspect, which gets a little blockchain-y, which is kind of fun, which is that the way that we sort of slash through the bureaucracy and get speed is that we use a trusted network of verified individuals in order to establish trust and verify that this individual's need and identity is sufficiently real, so that when we present the story to a sponsor, we can show them the sort of human chain of trusted connection that allows us to substantiate that this person's need is legitimate. And so what we talk about it sometimes is sort of we're building a human blockchain. And so that is the mechanism by which we've been able to sort of make the application very lightweight, and we don't have any requirements for like uploading bank statements or send us a copy, you know, any, we don't have to take any personal identifiable information. We're able to operate in a much, you know, faster and efficient manner, but still be able to provide that veracity to the sponsor to give them the confidence that the people we're presenting them with really have a genuine need.
Yeah, I love that. It's you're taking the best elements of something that you know to then drive it to kind of how you're thinking through how you set up the process for validation, right? That's excellent.
Absolutely, yeah. And you know, essentially what I think of it as is that we've created a protocol for connecting people who want to give with people who need support, and that we've created that shared values community in a human network that sort of expands node by node by node in a decentralized way. And so we're sort of, without the technology of blockchain, I think we're using a lot of aspects that are promoted as being enabled by something like that.
Yeah, no, I love that. You know, I've said that a lot myself, that, you know, I think for me, the biggest benefit of getting involved with blockchain and cryptocurrency and Bitcoin has been more just the way it's allowed me to change my thinking and mm-hmm. like how I think about the relationship of value between a participant in a network, or how you might validate people and so forth that have nothing to do necessarily with tech, but it's more of like you're bringing in those principles just to how mm-hmm. you're
thinking about governance, you're thinking yeah. about protocol, you're thinking about identity, you're thinking about roles that different people play to cross check each other, and that all of those things together really enable an ecosystem to have sort of a common purpose. And a common purpose network is really what I think, you know, something like Ethereum is built to enable, where, you know, you establish the rules of the game, you invite people into that community, and then everyone does their thing according to the protocol, and that common purpose can be achieved. And I've always been fascinated by that, and use cases for it, as you know, we've talked about this. We love to toss around blockchain use cases. But this was really sort of one that we were enabling sort of without the technical side of it. This is not a blockchain project, but that sure. thinking definitely came into play as yeah. we were architecting how this process and protocol would work.
No, it's great. I mean, I talk a lot about like product management and product strategy and mm-hmm. like requirements. And, you know, one thing I make the argument often is that, you know, when an enterprise thinks about blockchain, they might not be thinking about like actual blockchain, for example. They're just trying to solve technical and business requirements, right? And so they're going to take the best elements of that, whether that be through governance or through software.
Absolutely.
Same thing for you, and right? So, it's like
you're
just, you have requirements that you're looking to achieve, and you found some elements and kind of how people think through that architecture to then lead you to what you're doing.
Totally. And so it was because, you know, I think you've seen my lecture, which is Cats, Dogs, and World Peace, which is a series of sort of metaphors and ways to explain blockchain to people who don't necessarily have a technical background or want to know the technology, but they just want to understand the concepts. And it's really the concepts that I continue to be fascinated by. I mean, that's just sort of my angle on it, but I do like the way that it enabled me to think about how to solve problems, for sure, and what community can do when they're properly engaged and incentivized together to operate as a decentralized group. So our group, for example, is we're all volunteers. We have a fiscal sponsor, but we're not a nonprofit. And that's really been a key element of our program, is that we are not an organization sitting in the middle. We are a protocol that brings people together. We just operate the protocol.
Yeah, that's great. That's great.
Yeah. So it's, I think that it's enabled people to do direct giving, which I think in looking at philanthropy, I think that that is a direction that there's a lot of energy with the next generation in seeing happen. And so getting to explore what it looks like to have people help other people so directly without there being an organization in the middle managing that direct give, totally. Facilitating it instead. And
right. You're so right. So, we're seeing across various industries like this this lack of need for that middle person, right? Or mm-hmm. maybe that middle
whether
person
it's loans
is more like a support
or
layer,
giving,
but that's it.
Or yeah, I mean, there are so many different sort of peer-to-peer opportunities, but I think, especially in philanthropy, the next generation is really demanding more control over where their dollars go.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Well, I'd like to move the conversation back on the venture capital side of things and like founder. And, you know, I'd love to understand from your point of view, just where you're seeing, call it the appetite for deals or the appetite for, founder and venture interaction when COVID kind of first put us under lockdown, the stock market went really down and you had a bunch of investors saying like, hey, well, we're like kind of sitting tight till we figure this out, or, you know, I can't make an investment because of the stock market. Now the stock market is just out of control. So it's like, you can't use that excuse anymore. Right. So,
yeah, I mean, I think it's really different for angels and VCs.
Totally.
And,
maybe even touch
on
that.
So there were a couple of different drivers that I saw, and I sat in on a couple of really interesting calls that Silicon Valley Bank organized with different, fund managers to really sort of share what we were all seeing and hear what LPs were thinking. And, you know, so I was able to get some kind of market intelligence from these different sources, but just in sort of connecting with different people and then observing sort of our experience was that when the uncertainty really sort of hit, I think the individual investor was able to just pull back so easily. They have no investing mandate. They invest when they want to invest and when they're excited to invest and when it makes sense to them. And so I think that pullback is completely logical and may still be playing out in some way. Angels with portfolio companies where they intend to sort of, you know, be a potential follow-on, some of them are reserving capital to be able to support the startups that they've already funded. And so that's another reason why net new entrants to the fundraising scene might be seeing less sort of funding engagement from individual investors, sort of those two driving reasons.
Makes sense.
But I think on the VC side, there is a mandate to invest. Once you've closed your fund, you're really looking to deploy that capital in the first 2 to 3 years. And so you do want to continue to deploy that capital in a really smart way. But it was also on them to sort of shore up their own portfolio companies too and make sure. They had to, you know, I think on the VC side, there was also a little bit of sort of like, okay, wait, what do we have to be ready for? And, but now what I'm seeing is that people are coming back to the table and that there is definitely active investing happening and on both the angel and the VC side. So I'm hopeful that we'll continue to see that because innovation does not correspond to the market. Does not correspond to COVID. As a matter of fact, this might create a new wave of innovation.
Right.
And it certainly is sort of upending, sort of making some startups, it's really a crushing sort of trend, and then others, it's an accelerator. And so, but there's always going to be innovation that's not tied to the market or to a particular crisis. And so as an investor thinking really long term, I think you always want to be able to be ready, but you do have to kind of make sure your strategy is going to work for making it through the near term.
Totally. Yeah, it's, you know, I think you're right. From the investors that I've been speaking with and just relationships I have, I can see that it seems like the energy is a little bit better than it was a few months ago. And it's funny because it's summertime. And so typically summertime is more like a dead time, but you know, just curious if you've noticed anything different even too from like this summer compared to past summers, you know, because of that maybe lull that was there for a little bit. And
Yeah. I mean, and I don't have as many years on the investor side or actively seeking fundraising. So I'll tell you more of what I've heard than what I know, which is that with Zoom, those who are comfortable with it and getting on these, you know, video chat kind of things, it's working and it's hyper efficient. So for some angels and angel groups, they're taking way more meetings because they're not driving around all these different coffee shops. So there is an efficiency that's happening. But for those who are sort of slower to adopt this as a way to build relationships and close deals, I think it slows them down. But I think that some people are really embracing it and sort of saying like, this is, you know, we have to adapt what we do and change our processes and make this work. But, you know, for me, it's been really interesting to sort of be sort of less concerned with people, where people are located, you know?
Right.
That's not the first question anymore about like, oh, where are you located? It's really an interesting sort of shift.
Totally.
I do think it has made fundraising to some degree more efficient, but it has made relationship building really more challenging.
I totally agree. Yeah, it's allowed me to meet people that normally maybe I wouldn't have reached out to, or, and I also feel like people say yes more than they ever have. Yes to a conversation at least. So I think that's super interesting.
Yeah. I think people are, I think that, and I think we're all sort of calibrating how many, online meetings we can handle per day.
Sure.
Cause I think there is like a general fatigue, sort of like the being on camera, being on for the meeting. And it's just sort of the dynamic that it creates and, you know, how you spend your day.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Minda, what type of advice do you have for founders right now? So, you know, there's definitely founders of all different stages right now. And what are some ways that they can be, you know, either having early conversations? Because, you know, we all know that you're not going to pitch an investor ideally like the second you meet them, right? Like ideally you're building some level of relationship. So that way when you are ready to pitch, you know, you kind of have that outreach point. But what are just your overall tips or thoughts for founders during this time?
Yeah, absolutely. And Yoko and I really enjoy talking to founders, and we do sort of fundraising 101 and present that to different groups of founders. And so when we talk to founders and sort of some of the broad general advice we give is to really understand the kind of capital that they need. And the first part of that is them plotting out a strategy of, you know, what capital do they need to accomplish a certain set of milestones that get them to the next funding inflection point. It shouldn't be just, hey, I need money to keep going. It should be, I need capital in order to get from here to here. And when I get to, you know, point B, I'll be ready for this type of funding because I will have hit these milestones. And so I think it's on the founder to really create and present a strategy for how they're going to use investor capital to build their business. And so I really like to see a founder either come to investors to sort of explore what that might look like or do their own research and sort of fill in those blanks for themselves. But I think really understanding that story of how capital is going to get you to the next place. And I think also in that, understanding what kind of capital is most appropriate. First of all, where do you fall on the, you know, being all risk versus having like really delivered value, right? Over time, you're building more value and you're de-risking. So there's sort of this like, risk goes down, value goes up, right? And so I think really understanding where you are and that there are a smaller number of people willing to invest at the highest risk stage, that friends, family, and fools category, and really where founders are investing in their own ideas. And so then you get into the angel category, but it's always a little murky sort of when that is. But there are some sort of common signals about when you are sort of more broadly investable. And that varies from person to person as an angel, and it is defined differently by different small VCs. So there's the timing aspect of it and you really having a clear understanding of where you are and a realistic one. So the analogy that I like to use for the differentiation between angel funding and VC funding is, you know, fuel that you would put in a car and rocket fuel that you would put in a rocket. Both can blow you up, but generally, angel kinds of capital is the kind that you can put in the car and drive to the launch pad. And then VC money is you're the rocket ship, you're gonna put rocket fuel in that thing, you're gonna go to the moon. So you're gonna go further, faster with, you know, higher velocity than maybe you are with the angel type funding. So it's different, what the analogy is sort of meant to describe is the different kinds of expectations for the speed and velocity at which you are really taking on the expectation for how quickly you need to move with that capital. Because when someone puts investor capital in, the clock is ticking on them wanting to get their exit. And they have different models for that. And angels might have a VC type model where they want you to move up and fast really quickly, or they might be okay with a, you know, 5 or 3x return in a couple of years. But VC money is really architected around a very specific strategy of putting a significant amount of capital in and really burning it fast and bright in order to go really far, really fast, and then get that return. And so you have to know when you're ready for the rocket fuel or whether it's just going to blow you up on the launch pad because you're unable to get far enough to get to the next inflection quickly enough to get the next round of VC funding. So once you're on these tracks, you have to really be aware. So I like to really, encourage people to think about the different kinds of funding and the different kinds of expectations that come with it. So that they understand what kind of business they want to build and what kinds of pressures the investment brings with it. So that's sort of the analogy that I like to bring to founders.
Yeah, it makes a ton of sense because you do different things with that different capital. So,
right. So yeah. It's not to say that there aren't some angels who apply a VC model, right?
Sure.
But if you're looking at a traditional VC and the kinds of returns they need to get, they need to invest in a opportunity that can return their fund. So every investment they make can't be an okay one. It has to have the potential of being an extraordinary one. So, there are just differences in the way that deals are evaluated, the amount of capital that someone would want to put in, and sort of the expectations for how fast and how far up to the right you're expected to move. So really understanding the alignment with your investors, and then also the differences of expectations of your investor group. If you have a bunch of angels and then some VCs, that they might have different desires for when that exit happens that would be in conflict. So there are just different dynamics of capital that I think are really important for a founder to understand when they're selling equity in their company to investors.
Totally. Yeah. So the way you make up your round of investors, completely can dictate the influence or the advice, I guess, that you get, as you move along.
Yeah. It's like understanding who you're listening to and right. Understanding the advice that you're getting and where is it coming from, whose perspective. And then I think also like really interviewing your investors to understand who they are. Like, if someone were to have a meeting with me, I would expect them to ask me what my process is, what my check size is. Am I at the beginning of my fund life? Am I at the end? Have I already deployed everything? Do I even have money to deploy? And I'm just meeting with founders to sort of keep relationships warm. Like, really feel free to ask those questions and really understand what do I invest in? Because I don't invest generally in hardware and healthcare, for example. So if you're bringing me those opportunities and I say no, maybe because it's just not my sector. So again, sort of understanding and being prepared to ask smart questions and having done your homework on your investors before you meet with them so that everybody's right. time is well used.
Yeah, I think that's a common pitfall that a lot of first-time founders make is that they hear that an investor wants to have a conversation with them because they reach out to them, and then you know they sit on this conversation only to realize that there's maybe not interest or so forth, and it's like, well, wait a second, what's going on? And not asking those right questions, like, you're like, hey, are you writing checks right now? Like, you know, what are those checks looks like? Because you might be going to an investor, you know, an angel, and like this angel only writes $10,000 checks or $5,000 checks, which is fine. But like, if your expectation is that you're getting $100,000 check from this person, then maybe that's not the person that you would want to reach out to and so forth.
Right, exactly. And there are ways that you can kind of find those things out, and asking directly should always be okay. But I think knowing the questions to ask is something that I would love founders to get that, you know, information on so that they feel comfortable with what kinds of questions are their most useful ones to ask.
Yeah. One question I'd love to ask you is about, you know, on these early stage founders, when they're starting thinking about how they're figuring out what they're going to do versus a convertible note or a price round, like how should they be coming into a conversation with an investor, knowing that sometimes an investor might want to dictate the terms, right? So just at least coming in with a plan, knowing that it might be adjusted, or what are your thoughts in that regard?
I mean, I think that the most important thing you can come to the table with is knowing the amount of money that it will take to accomplish the milestones that get you to the next inflection point for funding. And then it's really just a matter of how can you price that? And so how do you price that risk? And that's a market-driven sort of thing. So, then it's up to, are you looking for a lead investor who's then going to set those terms and that's really going to define your round? But generally, if you are, an early stage company and, you don't maybe have a lot of revenue, maybe one customer, maybe your pre-product and pre-revenue, you really are going to find that your cap for like a convertible note or a safe might be in the 3 to 5 million range. And it's not because you can sell your company for that amount. It's not that. It is a calculation of sort of how much equity you might sell, which is like 20 to 30% in each round in terms of dilution, and sort of what the usual first fundraise is. So it's almost sort of like the basic math of selling 20 to 30% of your company for about 750K. So it's sort of just doing the math. And then that's why the sort of first level valuation is usually around that point. And I think understanding too, that a lot of angels, once that cap or valuation gets above 10 million, that they really sort of pull back and feel like there's not enough ownership, percentage there for them. And that's really more when VCs take over. So understanding that what inflection point you sort of price out different types of investors. And and VCs too. Like for example, some VCs have a very clear ownership target and a maximum check size they're willing to write for that ownership target. And if you're not within that economically, because you've got a lead that, just market dynamics, like the economics may not line up for their portfolio sure. strategy. So just really understanding a little bit about what amount of funding you need to get to the next step. And then it's really a matter of, are you going to have a lead, or are you just sort of, going to piece things together for multiple investors? But really the most important part is coming to the table, having realistic expectations about what investors are seeing in the market for what caps are for companies that are at your stage. So again, really understanding where you are in the trajectory of being all risk versus truly having de-risked the opportunity and created substantial value. And so really being very clear and realistic about what the market response is going to be to that is important. And you can learn that by talking to other founders. You can learn that by kind of seeing what's going on GeekWire and PitchBook. Do your research as much as you can, and then feel sure. free to talk to investors and get multiple data points, because we all just see what we see. But again, sort of being smart about the landscape of investing. That's why one of the things I think is really something that a founder might do, train yourself to be an angel investor, even if you're never going to write a check. There are a lot of resources out there for how to think about angel investing and what you do. So the more you can kind of put yourself in that investor seat, the better you're going to do at sort of designing something that will interest them and talk to their perspective. And similarly, you can learn how to do, you know, what a venture capitalist would do. So, you know, taking the time to sort of just use those resources that are out there to learn that. A lot of founders find this, you know, all of that being like a huge distraction because they're just trying to build their business, which is ultimately what they should do. But if they are going to use investor capital as a way to build their business, then they have to be knowledgeable and strategic about that part of their business building, just as they would be about building the right team at the right time. So it is, if you're going to go the path of raising capital, and that is sort of a multi-stage process for you, you really need to be smart about it. Don't let the, you know, that's not an investor-driven process. That should be a founder-driven process, and you're, you know, smart in working with your investors. So I think it's,
it's kind of like a little bit of the art of war in the sense of like knowing who your, you know, who your enemy is or your opponent, you know, better set, right? I'm not trying to say that in a conflict type of way, of course, but I totally agree. Yeah. Like I sit in on, I've either snuck in or sat in on like venture or angel type of lesson type groups and so forth. And because, you know, at some point, perhaps I'd like to do that, but for learning.
But like, there's no barrier to learning. There is an accreditation status for writing the check, but everything up and until then is absolutely accessible learning. And Yoko and I run something called Deals and Drinks, where we invite a founder in to do a pitch, but really for educational purposes. And then what we do with that pitch in the Q&A is the founder drops off, and then we have a discussion about like, well, what did you hear? What did you think about this? Would you ask this? Would you ask that? Like, what would be the next question? You know, and we really sort of look at like, how are we all hearing things and using our knowledge to develop a point of view? And what I enjoy about that discussion is that we try and bring in people who are not just investors. It's great to bring investors in. We try and populate it with a lot of different kinds of people. And the idea is sort of that we can all learn from that kind of understanding and share the table more than sort of the art of war mentality. And so especially at pre-seed, I would like to, you know, Yoko and I really feel strongly about sort of reducing the power and information asymmetry between, you know, founders and funders.
Yeah, I love that. Love that. Yeah. Well, Minda, I love to end by asking a question that I ask everyone, and that is, what is a question that you have that you'd like to ask our audience that they can think about as they go about their day?
Oh, okay, because I know exactly what I'm going to say. This is going to be a big old plug for the 1K project right now. Okay, and here goes. Is that, first of all, I'd like to say something, and then I'll say what my question is.
For sure.
Them, which is, one, how to get knowledgeable and involved in the 1K project as a sponsor or someone who is a supporter. And that's go to the 1kproject.org website or find us on Twitter at 1kproject.org. Or text us to donate. And the donation number is on our website. It's really easy to find, but I'm also going to read it out on air, which is 815-552-8075. So if you text that number and put in $250, someone's going to send you back a link to a GoFundMe page, and you can donate right then to a person who needs help.
Excellent.
So now here comes the question, and it's really sort of a challenge to your audience, which is, who can you help right now? Because we are surrounded by people who are in different levels of need. We're in the same storm, but we're not on the same boat. So I would encourage everyone to think about who they could help directly. So whether it's through the 1K project, because we can facilitate those connections, or whether it's just you understanding who in your community might need help, I think it's really important that we are aware of our surroundings and the people that are sort of in our community connection who might really need support right now. You know, stepping forward to be that person in your community is something that I think we can all do. Certainly we've tried to make it easier and more scalable, but I would challenge everyone to think of themselves as a giver in this situation to the extent that that's possible for them. And if you do need help, then, you know, come to the 1kproject.org website and find out how to become part of the network where you can apply for a sponsor. So the question is the challenge, which is really who can you help directly?
Yeah, love it. I love it. Minda, what are some good ways that people can stay in touch with you, see what you're up to, and so forth?
Well, yeah, absolutely. So I'm just going to give out my email because I'm always happy to hear from people. And that's just Minda, M-I-N-D-A, at firstrowpartners.vc. So send me an email, hit me up on LinkedIn. I really love to be contacted by people I've never met before with an understanding of how they think we might connect and why. And, you know, I look forward to hearing from lots of different people for lots of different reasons. But, you know, the things I'm most passionate about are bringing more people into the investing ecosystem and supporting founders at the earliest parts of their journey. So if either of those two things are sort of, you know, things you would want to talk about, I'd be delighted to connect.
Excellent. Awesome. Well, Minda, thanks so much. It's good to see you.
Thanks for having me. Yeah. I miss seeing you, Jonathan.
I know.
We used to see each other all the time and catch up. And now we have to do things like this.
Video. Hopefully soon.
It is really fun to catch up.
Yeah, it was. Really was. I'm glad. It was good because like this interview was just like a big catch up. So it was awesome. Awesome. Everybody, thank you for listening to another episode of the TF Podcast. Please make sure that you are liked and subscribed wherever you're listening to this. Do us a favor and fill in those stars. And you can make sure to follow us at TF Labs_, as well as myself at JG Product on Twitter.